Osiris.
I witnessed John walking across the living room in Bel Air, and he put his hand in his pocket and pulled out a Benny, and another Benny fell out too, but he didn't realize it. But China did notice it, and she started scrambling across the carpet, and it was all I could do that I actually got there before she put it in her mouth. And that's when I just said, there's no way I'm going to save this marriage. There's no way I can be his mommy and her mommy at the same time.
Welcome to Discograffiti, the music obsessives podcast that gives freaks like you and me the chance to connect with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with 3 to 4 episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. Each new guest swings a hard left into an area you either had no idea you needed to know about or know all about and can't believe you're not alone out there. I am thrilled to announce that we have partnered with the podcast network Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music. You can check out all their music podcasts at osirispod.com. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on the mamas and the papas, along with our unbelievably special guests, band biographer Richard Campbell, who's published an amazing bio, almost like a prequel really, called Getting Kinda Itchy, and Be Still My Beating Heart, the absolutely radiant goddess herself, Michelle Phillips, who'll be sifting through the sacred transmissions issued forth from her younger self and rating them all, every last LP and single, from 0 to 5 stars. This is part 3 of an epic new series called From a 16-Hour Interview, called Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, in which Michelle looks back with shockingly raw candor at a life exquisitely well-lived. In part 3, Michelle reveals a fascinating account of her participation in the origin of 1967's Monterey Pop Festival, the first rock festival of the modern era, her harsh, gloves-off opinion of the Mamas and the Papas' third LP, Deliver, and whether or not she felt any countercultural guilt over being the first rock group to opt for Learjet travel instead of vans and cars. Before we kick things off, just a quick word from Michelle.
Hey, lads and ladies. Michelle Phillips here from the Mamas and the Papas. If you're like me and you want it all, then why in the world would you settle for a trimmed down version of my interview? To get access to the extended director's cut of this and all future episodes, just join Discograffiti's Patreon. Dave Gebro's been singing for his supper for over 2 years now. The guy puts out several shows a week, and it's just the best music podcast of all time. You're not going to want to miss a single minute of it. Patreon.com/Discograffiti. Do it.
If you're a Michelle Phillips and Mamas and the Papas super fan like me, you'll want to turn this free version off right now and opt for the ultimate director's cut of this episode on our Patreon page, which features a whopping 34 additional minutes of essential material. And you can find it in our Patreon record shop for mere pennies at patreon.com/discograffiti/shop. Or just subscribe for the complete versions of all our shows. Even if you're on the fence, just head over there, because it's finally free to become a basic member. I'm going to take this opportunity now to give a shout out to brand new Patreon member Tyler Davis, an 18-year-old young man with great taste and a soft spot for the Mamas and the Papas, who literally canceled his cable TV and subscribed to Discograffiti at the Brigadier General tier, which is $40 a month. Trust me, if he can find a way, so can you. Tyler, I love you, and you are seriously my hero. Okay, first things first, you need to know just how seriously I take this craziness. Discography is a music obsessive's dream come true. The guest and I explore an artist or band's entire discography in a futile but valiant attempt to reach a higher truth, which often is cleverly disguised as a nerdy compendium of star ratings and lists. The show is heavily researched, and the music is always reassessed with fresh ears. We don't just cover albums. We do a searingly honest deep dive analysis of all EPs, singles, comp tracks, relevant solo work, and sometimes even bootlegs and live stuff. Every release is slapped with an objectively accurate star rating between 0 and 5, which allows us all, the real reason we do this, the Tootsie Pop reward at the center of the rock and roll lolly, to come face to face with the true shape of an artist's overall arc. Coming up, we've got Robert Schneider rating the Strawberry Alarm Clock, the Lemon Twigs, and the three surviving Dedrick siblings rating everything they ever released as one of the greatest bands of all time, bar none, the Free Design. Not to mention tons more Michelle Phillips. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then to check back in where we were. You guys had released the second record, which Richard and I just cannot get enough of, and which you, thank God, gave 5 stars. Before we kind of move ahead with what's happening here, I want to check in on where our partying levels are at this point. And by our, I don't mean yours. And as we established in the previous taping, always trust a junkie. In John's book, he says, and I want you to tell me if you perceive this as truth or a total fabrication. There was the unending stream of pot and acid, but also black beauties to keep going, reds to come down. And apparently he talked about you guys being gifted a box of free drug samples from a doctor's office by a friend at that time.
You have to remember something. I left the house in 1968. And what happened from that time onward, I can only imagine the horror of it.
But he's talking before then.
1966.
Oh, no, this is not true. There were not boxes. Oh, wait a minute. There was one box.
There we go.
There was a friend of his that brought him a box of samples that he found outside of a doctor's door to be thrown away. And he took the box and gave it to John as a Christmas present. So in fact, that is true.
I know it's a while ago, but do you remember in 66 feeling like you're kind of crossing a line here, dude? Or did you feel like this is just part and parcel of the times? Or did you not think twice of it, really?
As you know, we were already doing amphetamines in folk music days. When I met John, he was already doing amphetamines. But as I said, I didn't consider that to be taking drugs in a negative way because they were being prescribed by a doctor to John.
Plus, you were using them to work. It's not like you were doing them and laying on the ground and drooling all over yourselves. You were
the
most timeless classics of all time.
Yeah. I don't know. It's so different. It's such a different period today than it was then. That if I could remember the amount of amphetamines we probably consumed, we'd probably say, oh my God, you know, you were in really bad shape. But that's not true. We're very productive and we worked a lot. We were singing a lot, especially with Denny. By the time we got to Denny in the group, we were working very hard. We worked very hard. And the amphetamines were kind of like a throwaway sideline. We didn't think about it as doing drugs. And you know, I don't remember even knowing anyone who did heroin in 65,
right.
66, 67. I didn't know anybody who did heroin in 67. 68, I started to get a feeling that, you know, I think that this terrible drug that my father warned me about is probably getting around.
That's when Cold Turkey came out by John Lennon. So I think there was more of a maybe a public awareness at the time. But this is all conjecture from me because people are around at the time. I think everyone has a different experience from all the people I've spoken with. That heroin, some people in their experience, they didn't see heroin until mid-70s. Some people early, just the people I've spoken with. Obviously, it was going to cross your path sooner rather than later because of the company you guys, you were at the top echelon of the social scene.
Well, the truth is, I have never seen heroin. I've never actually seen it. I've been offered it and I said, no, I don't do that. So I never actually physically saw it ever in my life. After the group broke up, according to David Crosby, who was such a brilliant asshole, he was telling people that he had done heroin with Cass. And I thought, what a horrible thing to say about somebody when they're gone. You know, he started saying this. What year did Cass die in, Richard?
74.
Okay, so it wasn't until then that I started hearing these stories that, you know, Cass had been doing hard drugs.
Well, even if she tried it, it doesn't make her a bad person. It's in the spirit of experimentation. You know, I mean, I've never come across anything that labeled her as a junkie or anything like that.
I'll tell you another thing. She also had, as you know, a lot of physical problems, and she was on opiates. And she had a kneecap replaced or something like that. And I would not doubt for a minute that Cass was addicted to opiates.
She acknowledged that after her knee surgery, I think on something like Mike Douglas, she said it got to her. She sort of laughed and she said, I'd wake up in the morning and why don't I have a brandy soda, she said. But she sort of got past that. And I was going to say, in fairness to her, like Michelle, you know, it's entirely possible that people like David Crosby or Pick Dawson, who was a nasty individual, people around her may have been doing some pretty harrowing things this far back. But, you know, I'm just thinking, it seems to me, from what I know, 1966, it's a typical party scene for a rock group after a concert. Right. There's some marijuana, there's some booze, and there's, you know, cigarettes, and it's a party atmosphere in hotel rooms, I think.
The only thing that would have been going around was alcohol and pot.
Right.
Honestly, I'm not just trying to smooth things over. That's the honest truth. Of course, thank God we hadn't been introduced to cocaine.
You know, honestly, I don't want to linger too much on drugs. That's peripheral at this point, completely peripheral. But there was a lot of irrefutable success happening, like success on a level that I'm sure you never imagined for yourself. And not only that, but in the music industry, heretofore, and I believe just based on his own writings and his own kind of BS techniques, it seems like John was the one who was like your big negotiator, who would get the Learjets, get the stream of money going directly from the office to the bank account, etc. So, you know, the relationship you had with Learjet, this is like a door that was open that never got shut again.
I'm going to blame Lou Adler for that.
You know, what I'm really curious about is, it's interesting enough that you guys are taking Learjets wherever you go, because no one had done that before in the music industry, because John's philosophy of, if you treat yourself like a star, everyone else will start too. And then they did. And that worked.
Oh, you know what? Enough. That's bullshit.
Good. Set me straight, please.
Because you know what? John loved to live high on the hog. Also, when we were in the Journeyman, we used to fly from one concert to another concert, maybe not on a Learjet, but we used to fly. We never took a bus. The only time we were on a bus was the Southern Lap of the Hootenanny Tour. Other than that, we were always traveling first class on a plane, or we had a chartered plane.
But you guys, and I'm being reductive by saying it like this, but I'm doing this to make a point. You guys are all flower children. You're children of the counterculture. But now you're living with a sense of, you could call it elitism, whatever it is, safe in your garden, right? It's a little bit of safe in your garden. And by the way, I don't judge you for this at all. I mean, I would be looking into the same shit you do. Why would I want to bust my ass driving 48 hours in a van when I can get there overnight? But because of the times, did any of that give you pause? Like, we're singing about this, but we're acting like this, or fuck that?
In answer to that question, not for a second.
Good, good.
I loved every second of the Learjet. You know, I remember when we were going up to Vegas once, and there were too many people to get on a Learjet, you know, of our friends. And I remember either Lou or John just saying the Learjet had to come from Idaho or something like that to pick us up, to take us to Las Vegas. And I remember someone just saying, well, send two.
So when did all the Learjet craziness, that kind of part of your life, it was that done by 69? Because I want to ask you, because I don't think I'll ever be in this situation where I have to get used to no longer having a Learjet at my beck and call. What is that acclimation process like? Is it a sad process? Is it a grateful? I don't have to deal with being that fucking person anymore. What is that like?
Well, In my particular situation, I was divorcing John in 1969.
Yeah, yeah.
And it meant that I had to leave my beautiful home in Bel Air, 2.5 acres in Bel Air on Bel Air Road. And I had a little baby, and China was not even a year old. And all of our bank accounts had been closed. John made sure that I had absolutely no access to cash. And I went to Malibu and I rented a little house, a little house. John made sure I had no access to the money.
Right.
And he thought that that was going to smoke me out and bring me back.
So at this point in 66, let's talk about the money. By the tour's end, by around, you know, fall 66, Words of Love and Dedicated to the One I Love, which, oh man, what a shining moment for you. I'm seeing that light behind you shine down in your head. That's what I feel like every time I listen to the song. And they're being played all over the country, over the world. Huge royalty checks are coming in, and you're being paid in suitcases filled with cash for your live performances. In fact, do you remember, was there an experience back at a hotel in Denver where you guys covered Cass in about 80 grand and $100 bills, and she rolled around in it and you danced all over the bills? Was there a night like that that you remember?
No.
That John. No. What a son of a gun.
John is so full of fanciful.
It's a good story, though.
And for John, being rich was really important. Really important. And frankly, being rich was very nice, but it didn't make me who I am. I liked having the money. But then for a long time, I had no money because John made it very, very difficult for me to even get my royalties. I mean, I had to borrow money to pay my bills, you know, and if I flew someplace, I went coach. There was no question about that. And so you get a different perspective depending on your situation.
Right.
My situation was keeping my head above water and not having the IRS come and take my car.
Well, I think the big difference, and, you know, we keep jumping to 69, but, you know, and just to close up 69 before we, you know, stay in 66, the big difference, it seems, and this is just some schmuck who was born in 72 saying it, but take it for what it's worth. But for all the research that I've done, it seems like the big difference between yourself and your ex at the turn of the decade is that you rolled with the changes. You realized your life had changed and you went in a different direction with open arms. You had a kid, you made mature, responsible adult decisions, and you switched everything up on a dime. And I gotta hand it to you, you know, especially at that time, you know, being a woman, I gotta imagine that was not quite as easy as you made it look to be.
I couldn't even get a mortgage because I was a woman and I didn't have a job that gave me a steady flow of money. And at this point, I had started to do some acting. I wasn't making a lot of money, but, you know, my acting career was starting to move a little bit. And I had to adjust to not having the money, but I was, more than anything, I was happy to be away from John.
Is it true that the two of you purchased 5 Rolls Royces?
Oh, God. We had 1 Rolls Royce and it was mine. By the way,
you know, what's amazing to me. Your story is naturally amazing, like in a mystical way. 17 passes on the craps table, snorkeling on it. Why do you have to punch up the details?
Because he's a lyricist. That's why. That's how John right. rolls. But I've heard this from Denny, too. I mean, when Denny read John's book, they said he'd be in the loo and you'd hear this yell. What? This didn't happen. And that sort of thing. I want to say while we're still in 69. Giving props to this mama, and I think it's true of Cass as well. I think parenthood is huge here. I think that Michelle needs to be credited with the fact that she was the parent. And sadly, for all the respect I have for John in a lot of ways, and he acknowledged this, he was not a good father and parent. And so I feel like that's a real turning point here too. Both when Owen and China were born, I don't want to say the jig was up, but these ladies at least had enough common sense. And they didn't really have any other choice at the time to say, hang on, this child has to have a parent. And so I think you can't get away from the mamas really becoming mamas and that furnishing some of what you're talking about.
Well, if I can just say this.
And then we're banned from 69. I'm just throwing that out
there. I think this was in 68 because I actually took John downstairs to the garden and put out a blanket. And I said, sit down because I have to tell you something. But before I had to tell him something, I witnessed John walking across the living room in Bel Air, and he put his hand in his pocket and pulled out a Benny, and another Benny fell out too, but he didn't realize it. But China did notice it, and she started scrambling across the carpet, and it was all I could do that I actually got there before she put it in her mouth. And that's when I just said, there's no way I'm going to save this marriage. There's no way I can be his mommy and her mommy at the same time.
So one thing about your marriage that's always, and when I met you years ago, it's the one thing that I mentioned to you, which is like this image that really stayed with me from, you know, all the research, is that chandelier. That chandelier, what's so amazing to me about that huge French chandelier in your foyer is that the bulbs started blowing right when you got there, right? Because there's so many of them. I'm picturing 100 bulbs. Who knows?
No, there were probably 12 bulbs in the chandelier, but it was such a beautiful piece of art. And it was there when we bought the house.
You gave him an ultimatum, right?
Yes. I said, John, the light is out in the chandelier. Why don't you just go up there and change them all at once? And he said, okay. So he didn't do it. And then another bulb went out. And I said, John, get up on the ladder and put some new bulbs in there. And he said, oh, okay, I will. And then another bulb went out. And I said, you know what, John, I got to tell you something. You better listen to me. When that last bulb goes out, I'm walking out the door. And that's exactly what happened.
So this is what is mind-boggling to me, is that it seems pretty clear that he loved you. And I'm guessing you loved him as well. But yet it seemed like the story had already been told. You guys had already gotten married and divorced. You just hadn't actually gone through with the divorce yet. It was like it was pre-written and you were living out a predetermined tale. It's almost like this is how it had to go. There was no other way for this to happen. Was there a feeling of destiny or inevitability to the end of things?
Well, I was definitely going to leave. I was not going to stick around to try to patch him up. Actually, right after I left, he started seeing Genevieve.
Well, we'll get there. Let's stay in 66, or else we'll never get to the end.
In 66, I would love to hear Michelle's memories of Carnegie Hall, because that's got to be at least one of the main apexes of the group. It's tremendous how we wish that concert had been recorded, but they're really at the zenith in terms of their chemistry. They've been recording. The two albums are out. The next month, they're going to be on Ed Sullivan for the first time.
It was an unbelievable honor to be able to play Carnegie Hall. They were not booking a lot of rock groups. I mean, they were booking the Philharmonic and Ballet. And, you know, it was a classical music venue. It was not even like the Bowl, which had already started booking rock groups. But I think the Beatles had played Carnegie Hall. So I think that there was a change going on. And to get out on that stage and saying, oh, my God, we're playing Carnegie Hall. It doesn't get any bigger or better or more prestigious than this.
Was that the biggest and best, or was there a different show that takes that distinction for you?
No, I think that that was the biggest and the best. I mean, I love playing the Hollywood Bowl.
Do you see it as more of a pinnacle even than Monterey?
Oh, yes. Monterey was a throw of the dice. I think John and Lou did an absolutely fantastic job with Monterey.
When you see stuff about the Fyre Festival and Woodstock 99 and all this stuff, are you like, yeah, that's my fault?
Yeah. Well, we were the first rock festival.
You began all this stuff. It must be amazing. Anything you see about music festivals, although maybe it's an inevitability that it would have been birthed, it was all set in motion by you and John and Lou.
Well, as you said, my life has kind of been one amazing coincidence after another. And I feel that the amazing coincidence for me at Monterey Pop was when I came off the stage crying and crying and crying. And then I realized I was pregnant. It's like the birth of a whole new world for me. I thought that the whole festival was a great success. I had no idea that 55 years later, we would still be selling Monterey Pop Festival albums and box sets. And, you know, Lou has done an incredible job.
Have you thought about Monterey Popcorn?
I think that's a great idea.
Multicolored?
Why didn't Lou think of that? Now I'm...
You needed me on your team, the marketing guy. All right, so album number three, February 1967's Deliver, which was recorded in autumn 66, came out in February. This one, it's your third album. There's a lot of covers on this one. This is probably the most, at least it seems, if you were just scanning everything, that you were, you know, living the high life to such an extent that there was not a heck of a lot of time to write new material.
I think I was pregnant during Deliver. I know that Cass did Deliver. We didn't have Cass with us a lot during that period because she was 7, 8, 9 months pregnant.
She did not go to the Grammys with John, Michelle, and Denny in March because she was that close to delivering in April.
And it's so weird, both the pregnancy and the birth was kept a secret, right, the whole time?
Well, she was wed, but the child wasn't Jim Hendricks. So Owen was born Owen Vanessa Hendricks.
As we talked about earlier, Cass married Jim Hendricks to keep him out of the draft, which right. I thought was a very noble thing for her to do. But she wouldn't tell anybody who the father was. And I begged her to tell me. I remember sitting around the pool when Owen was a little girl and China was a little younger. They were playing in the pool and Cass was going to go to London the next day to play the Palladium. And I said, Cass, why don't you just tell me who the father is? And she laughed and she said, I'll tell you when I come back. And of course, she never came back. And it wasn't until Owen turned 18 that she asked me to help her find her father, which we did.
I'm scratching the needle off this, and I'm placing it very gently down on track one, side one, one of the great chills down the spine opening moments of any record ever, is your version of Dedicated to the One I Love. Brought it to the band, right? This was you delivering it, you saying, yeah. We should do this. And oh my God, the beginning when your vocal is isolated. And also, this is a huge thing for you, I believe.
My intonation is a little iffy.
No. You were talking about authenticity before. I feel everything that you're singing in that, as if you're creating the song from the ground up when you're delivering it. And the only thing that kept you out of the lead spot was Happy Together by the Turtles. Which is, you know, at least understandable, but oh my God, this is probably the best cover that you guys have ever done. And you know what it is? It's not even authenticity, it's vulnerability. There's something about your vocal alone, isolated without any accompaniment, and then everyone joining in. You sound like you're laying it all on the line, and it's not, it's a cover song. Usually there's not that kind of what feels at least like emotional investment in something like that. In fact, the next song, Richard and I disagree on this, but the next song is, it's a study in contrast to me. My Girl, it doesn't feel like it has that same emotional investment.
It was not lined up properly on the album. I agree with you. That particular period of time when you had competition to get to the top of the charts. You didn't just sail to the top of the charts. You had all of the Phil Spector stuff. You had Motown. You had the Beatles. You had the Stones. You know, it's like, you know, like you're clawing your way up to the top of the charts. And it was a really beautiful, beautiful time to be in the music business because you got no free passes.
Are you insinuating that the quality barometer has slid over the decades?
Yes.
Have you heard the song WAP?
I don't know what music is anymore to people. I don't know what music is. I was kind of lost at disco, to tell you the truth.
Hi, I'm Dave Gebro. I threw my career as a licensed hearing instrument specialist in the trash, sold my house, and moved to the East Coast with my wife and four-year-old son in order to focus on making the ultimate podcast for music obsessives thrive. Now I need your help. Although Discography is rated in the top 2% of all podcasts globally, the economics of this thing are tricky. Becoming a member of Discography's Patreon gives you access to over 100 more exclusive episodes. And moving forward now, every Sunday, for only $5 a month as a private first class, you get our new weekly show by and for Discography's Patreon family, the Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. If all you want to do is show some love, there's now finally a $1 tier. Don't miss out. Become a recruit and get your personalized backstage pass for $1. And for the cheapskates, homeless people, and all the bums sponging off mom and dad, don't care, just join. It's now completely free to join as a basic member, and it'll be the only place you'll be able to get our upcoming Lou Barlow, Corey Hansen, Mark Robinson, Will Hart comp, Metal Machine Muzak, as well as the triple album rock opera El Farmony I created with Joe Kennedy, and the ability to purchase one-off Patreon episodes. That's it. Back to the show. So it's at this point where I'm going to step aside. We had two covers, but now we're at, is it Creaky Alley or Creek Alley?
Creek Alley.
Creek Alley. Okay, so I'm stepping aside for this reason. This is an ingenious mythological overview of the entirety of your history up to that point as a band. And it's at this point in the story where I feel like the best person to tell the tale along with you is just Richard. Richard, as we are talking about in the intros to all these episodes, has written an absolutely mind-blowing book that's lovingly put together and is gorgeously assembled with incredible photos. And it's all of the various tendrils that came together to form the Mamas and Papas. It's called Getting Kinda Itchy. And if I could, I just want to sit back and be entertained by you and Richard doing a line-by-line breakdown of this classic hit single.
We can do that.
You co-wrote this, right?
Yeah, I co-wrote it.
So the story that you're telling...
When I say that, that's a very loosey-goosey thing to say because John wrote most of it, really. But I did actually write that lyric, Getting Kind of Itchy.
Nice, nice. Yeah. So here's what I want to proffer, that you took a story that is, I think actually one of you was trying to explain how you got together as the Mamas and Papas. Was it Lou who was asking, Richard, who was it who asked?
Somebody, it may have been John, said at the time that Lou kept saying, now, how do you know? How did this all happen? And they would tell him, well, you know, we were here and then we knew them there. And so it was sort of a way of once and for all laying out the roadmap, which is what I did, I guess, in prose form in the book.
That's the coolest thing about your book. It takes this song and it expounds on it. So, you know, you could just take the first line or two of the lyrics and then there's a chapter on it. It's really cool. So you're basically doing a remix of the song.
You know, the truth is that we came up with a lot of great rhymes and things for the song, but we did not use them because they weren't actually factual.
Last time that John was truthful in song.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. But it was so much fun to write this song. I'm telling you, we wrote it very quickly, but we threw a lot of material away because we wanted it to be truthful. This is the way it happened. And, you know, it just kind of came like a little angel to us that morning as we were sitting in the pub on Bel Air Road. John had the idea for the song.
Has that ever been done before? Has there ever been a band not just telling their story, but telling it in like, this happened, then that happened, then that? I don't think it had ever been done before. It's kind of brilliant.
I don't know. I was astonished that we were able to bring it all together, but we had so much to draw on. John, Sebastian, and Zal Yanowski. And the truth was, Denny wanted to be able to play guitar like Zal. And when we started talking about that, that was the lyric. Hey, Zali, golly, don't you think that I wish I could play guitar like you? And we said, brilliant.
So do me a favor, the two of you, will you please, beyond the things that we've covered in great detail, factoids in here that maybe could be easily missed?
Okay, well, I'll start getting kind of itchy. So they want to move along, right? They're getting kind of itchy just to leave the folk music behind, which is what really is the whole theme of my book, Getting Kind of Itchy. While that's going on, Zal and Denny have sort of spun out because Denny had been in the Halifax Three. And that band sputtered out. Zal Yanofsky was sort of a latecomer addition to the Halifax Three, which became four and then five at one point in time. They had traveled with John and Michelle in the Hootenanny Tour in late 63. So trying to get a fish on the line, I think, is maybe a nod to Halifax. I don't know. That's where Denny was from.
Well, they were trying to put together a group that was going to get some traction, you know, and they did. And they did. Because look at who's in the Mugwumps. I mean, Cass and Denny and Zal, John Sebastian. I mean, all of these people became famous in other groups.
Right.
So it's almost kind of creepy how it all comes out because everybody had a shot at it. And all these people ended up in the song.
You know what I always thought, by the way? I later learned it's the incorrect read on the song. But I wish this was the idea going into it. The very final verse where you say, our imaginations can't go on indefinitely. For the longest time, I thought that was you guys saying, we're going to break up soon. Where you're actually not just telling your story from the past, but you're looking into the very near future and saying, it's coming to an end.
I think that the magic of the Virgin Islands, that magic, we're still in the Virgin Islands. You know, as the lyric is being written, we're not physically in the Virgin Islands, but we're talking about it like we're in the Virgin Islands.
But you were still coursing on the fumes of that same luck.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Duffy's Good Vibrations and Our Imaginations can't go on
indefinitely. Duffy's Good Vibrations. We knew that we couldn't go on singing at the club at Duffy's. And Our Imaginations, which were, I guess that's writing the songs, can't go on indefinitely. And you know that you can't ride that wave indefinitely. There is going to come an end to it.
Here's the genius, you know, and this is, of course, you and John, but some of the genius involved here is that it's so self-referentially, it's like, okay, I'm going to make an album, but I'm too busy, so I'm going to put a lot of covers on it. I'll make sure the covers are really good, but then I'll reference the fact that my imagination is skidding to a halt because of all this within a song on that record, which gets me a get out of jail free card as a songwriter. It's genius. I don't even know if he meant for that to be the case, but it's amazing.
I think we all kind of saw that. And we knew that we were living in a graced bubble. And John said this once, and I always like to take credit for saying it, but he said it first, was... The Mamas and the Papas were like a little bubble, and all you had to do was prick it once and it would all disappear. And that's what I think John was seeing in the future. This was not going to go on forever.
But, you know, the cool thing about you guys is that it almost felt like, and again, armchair psychologists would tell me, Dave, stop being a douche. That's not how it went down. But here's how I see it is, you know, that kind of situation for me would provoke a lot of fear about how do I stay on top? You know, everything I do is going to number one. At some point, you know, what if it doesn't? And in order to distract myself from thinking myself into a hole, what better way than these sort of, you know, in and out of bed shenanigans? Then all the focus is taken off how scary that is, and you can create your own preemptive strike against fate coming down on you.
Yeah, but I, for instance, I never had any ambition. I didn't have any ambition by the time we were making big top 10 records. I never had that ambition. John did.
Did you care about staying in it?
No.
If it disappeared immediately, you could give a rat's ass and you'd move on with your life and do something different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in a way, I was freed from my obligation to work so hard. I'm really kind of a sloth. I don't like to, you know, get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and start writing a song.
Or be woken up at 3 in the morning to write a song.
Yeah, yeah, that's not me. I try to be a good mother. I try to be a good cook. I try to enjoy my life and travel. And I have the greatest life. I can't imagine anyone having a better life than I have right now.
What's the phrase? Bon vivant.
A bon vivant.
You know how to live correctly.
There must be a feminine.
Bon vivant.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Before we move on to Sing for Your Supper, how many stars do you give Richard C. Campbell's Getting Kind of Itchy?
5. I am so impressed by his book because how someone gets all this fucking information, it's a whole life's work. And he put this puzzle together that would take up the space of this entire carpet. He did that.
Yeah.
And people should read this if they want to understand music from the 60s to the 70s. If they really want to understand that brilliant time, they should know all the people that were involved in it and how they came together and how they made that happen.
You're very fortunate because you don't choose what people flock to maintain your legacy. It could be right. Some real schmo, but you got a guy who really dots his I's, crosses his T's, and truly loves everything you guys do. And that's—
Thank you, Billy.
Yeah, no, please, thank you.
Thank you. One thing I'd like to ask about Creek Alley, or just for the history, I mean, I've heard it before, but Michelle, I think people would love to hear the line about Cass was not just glibly thrown down. I mean, the story I've heard is that John threw it out there and you said, that's a great and funny line. Just like you've told us, there's some other lines that didn't make it into the song, but we can't use that.
But we're not going to use it. And we're not going to sing that for her. Period. You know, it's cruel and it's harsh and it's not in the spirit of the song.
She enjoyed that line, didn't she?
She loved it.
Yeah.
And I don't think she was faking it. She started to laugh hysterically. And I remember she threw a pillow. She had a pillow on her lap. And I told John, I'm not singing that line to her. I actually turned around and let John sing it to her. And she laughed hysterically. And she took this pillow and she threw it at John. And she said, that's so fucking funny. I love it. And when you listen to it on whatever you listen to it on the vinyl or the tape or whatever, Cass is singing her heart out. She's right out front. And she really did think it was a good lyric. That's what's amazing to me, is that she told me later, she says, I'm not offended by that.
That's one of the greatest Cass stories to me, because frankly, my whole life, every time I hear that song, I kind of feel bad for her. And now every time I hear it, it'll be a different experience for me. Let's talk about another one that she belts out with great fervor. The 4th song on the record, Sing for Your Supper, is again from that Rodgers and Hart special, along with My Heart Said Still, Glad to Be Unhappy, and Here in My Arms. This is the kind of stuff she loved, right? She loved these belters like this.
She was right at home.
I have to say, it's not really up my alley, this kind of stuff. I appreciate it more than I love it, I'd have to say, but it's more a personal inclination. How about the two of you?
I love it, but I love musical theater. I mean, I think she's in her element, so I feel like it's a chance for her to go there, and I think John sort of gave her that.
I'm not a big fan of musical theater, but I love those tracks and those performances. I have some aversion to actors breaking out into song in the middle of a scene.
Especially if it's not a musical.
What? What's going on here? You know, we're telling a story. Do you mind? But Cass...
Have you ever seen Les Parapluies de Cherbourg? Have you ever seen that movie, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg? The whole thing's a musical. So it's like, I'm going to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, it's more like an opera then, yeah.
And I love opera, but I would hate The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Twist and Shout. I love Twist and Shout because I feel like you're revisiting very fertile Do You Want to Dance territory, where there's a soft, satiny redux of A World Gone By, which works perfectly because with Free Advice next, it's a real dichotomy of looking back to a bygone era and whoa, are we in a different spot now? Love that dichotomy there.
We're in a very different spot because John was really having writer's block. And I don't think that Free Advice is a very good record.
I love it because, well, here's the thing. As far as a full album goes, you know, on its own, it's not as developed as, say, the song that comes next, Look Through Any Window, but we'll get there in a sec. But this is more, first of all, is it an ode to drug paranoia? Is that basically what it is?
I have no idea.
That's what it reads as to me. Richard, what's your take on this?
Well, it seems like that's a little bit like Straight Shooter in that regard. You know, a bit of Free Advice, we'll tell it to you now. If you've got some habits, some people won't allow.
I don't know what John, who he was placating to make this happen, but holy fucking shit, Michelle, at a time when the orthodoxy was pounding on your door, if you sang songs about marshmallow skies, this is so hysterically upfront with all of its drug obsession panoply. I mean, and there's like a carefree honking juke joint sax, almost like it's like a 1963 Beach Boys song.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. All these references to...
But he's not beating around the bush at all. At all.
We've all got our ups. We've all got our downs.
How the fuck?
Some of us are chemists that leave them lying around.
How the hell did he get away with this? How did you guys not get on the banned list, get in trouble with disc jockeys? What's going on there? It seems like everyone else...
Because everyone was doing it.
I know, but even if there was hints, subtle hints, your song would get banned. And here's John saying, and I'm shooting in my veins. You know, I mean, he might as well just
He doesn't say that really, does he?
Tongue in cheek. But it's like he's more blatant than anyone, and he's the only one who's not cracked down on. It's amazing. I don't know how that works.
I'm stuck here because I have no idea why it wasn't cracked down on. I think because most groups were at least making some reference to...
Yeah, it was like a wink, like a nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
You know, even when the Peter, Paul, and Mary song came out, I mean, you know that that's about pot.
Yeah.
And that was a big hit. I think maybe the government got used to it a little bit.
Oh, hi. I got to tell you about the next tier. As a lieutenant, you get an ad-free, substantially elongated director's cut of every episode. And you'll be getting the shows a few days earlier than the general populace, which is designed to make you feel even more special than you already are. And now back to our expertly crafted program. Later on, and again, I'm like really wanting to keep myself planted in 67, but not that far in the future, you guys would try your hand at a couple of, you know, tentative steps into acid rock. But to me, the real revolution in what you were doing was you were out freaking all those fucking people, but your songs could hang with AM or FM.
John was also very intrigued with the idea of drugs. And so maybe that's how it got on the record,
right?
Because he was trying to write about something that he didn't really know, but maybe he was going to know about it.
No, I think what you just said is it, because here's why. I feel like he has memories of the future. And mainly, I think the reason why he does is because just like the dripping French chandelier and the two of you knew it was, you know, the marriage was done. You just had to live it out first. Same with his relationship with drugs and his addictions. I think he knew it was going to happen in a big way for him at some point, but it was just a matter of time because he leaves this breadcrumb trail in his songs that allude to that.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think that that's
the biggest one is on Wolf King. We'll get to it. But, well, you know, there's that line in Wolf King. Everyone thought I was smarter than to get over my head. There it is. There's the rest of his life right there in one line.
What song is that?
Is it Malibu People?
Somewhere down the beach. She's sleeping in the an old friend. Yeah. Well, that was happening.
I'm pulling us back into 67 because I can't wait to talk to you about Wolf King and about Victim of Romance. Let's instead flip deliver and talk about a very important song. Look Through My Window feels to me like a goodbye to the old records you guys used to make.
Look Through My Window is a masterpiece. It was not given its proper due. It's unbelievable.
One of your best songs.
Looks in my window, yeah, to the streets below.
See the people hurrying by.
With somewhere to be.
Somewhere to go.
Whoa.
He's got no place to go.
And this is, isn't this based on John thought you were 3,000 miles away and you were just fucking around on him right down the street, basically, where like he thought you could be just walking right by the apartment?
I have very little memory of that period of my life.
That was circa 64. I mean, so, you know, this has been written, I think, for a few years. Richard, is that right?
I think that's right. I mean, 1230, California Dreamin', those songs precede really the Mamas and the Papas. I mean, he honed them and he worked on them.
I love the line, lovers sometimes rearrange. What an understated way to paint a picture of devastating heartbreak.
Yeah.
What does that lyric mean to you? I mean, when you hear the line, lovers sometimes rearrange, talk about a huge understatement. But what did it mean to you to live the way you felt like living back in the early 60s? Forget about late 60s. Early 60s was a different time from what I read about.
I was not tethered to anybody. I mean, let's face it, my father was married 5 times after my mother died. And I just grew up knowing that when it was over, it was over. And you got out of there. And that started with my relationship with Russ when I went back to Los Angeles. And I was very, very much attracted to Russ Titelman. And I had an affair with him. And even though I did go back to John.
Did you ever revisit that as a thing after the two of you got divorced?
No. Well, I've only seen Russ 1 time since then. And that, strangely enough, was at John and Genevieve's.
Wow. That seems surprising to me because you speak about him in such glowing, nourishing ways.
About Russ?
About Russ.
Yeah. Well, he was a wonderful guy. That just wasn't going to work out for him to be involved with a married woman. I mean, his parents were practicing Jews, and this was verboten. You know, you could not just move in to another man's wife into her arms just because you fell in love.
By the way, we objectively make the best husbands.
Well, I'm sure you do. Yeah.
So I think this is the most serious song, at least on this side of the record, maybe the whole album. I mean, dedicated, but I think this is even more introspective. Mm-hmm. In terms of material, you know, after this, it kind of goes a little bit lighter, and it's certainly light in terms of composition. As Michelle said, they're running out of material for this album. You know?
It's a weird thing, though, on side two. And I know, Richard, that I believe you and I see it in a similar way. This side is almost like a concept album in itself, because Look Through My Window starts almost impossibly lush. You can't follow up this song with another song that's as lush. So what's going to happen is some of that studio luster is going to peel away. But interestingly, as the side progresses, the record, in a way that I find incredibly interesting, totally falls apart. And I'm saying in an aesthetically satisfying way, because I don't know who sequenced the record. I'm guessing it was John, or was it the whole group?
John or Lou, I would think.
So the fact that it goes from the most lush song on the whole record, and then by the last few songs, it's like fragments, basically. You have an instrumental, you have a 1 minute kind of interlude that ends it. It's strange, and I love it. Actually, as a side, I think it is oddly more cohesive than the first side because of that weird element to it.
So Boys and Girls Together is the next song, and that was actually profiled on ABC TV as a song on a show called The Songmakers, and they showed Michelle, John, Cass, and Denny making the record, how you record a record, how records were made. It's interesting with the mariachi band. I mean, there's no other song like it.
We got to talk about that bass line, though, because that bass line rules the song. Whoever came up with that,
Joe Osborne.
That is beautiful. Boom, ding, bam, boom, 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 boom. So cool. And it's really this sort of Sergeant Peppery. The mood is Eastern and opium saturated. And what I like is that there's this flowing, flowery atmosphere. And then the lyrics are totally knuckleheaded.
Yeah. It's really obvious that we're running out of material.
No. I meant that in a good way. I love Boys and Girls.
I'm looking at it in a bad way.
Okay, got it.
I think it's pretty obvious that we're running out of material.
You don't like this song?
No.
No, okay.
I mean, I even like some of the lyrics. Like two sides of a coin, we are forever joined. I think it's beautiful. Denny is working it in this song. It's an unusual song. I don't think it had a whole lot of commercial capabilities, but I think it's good work. And it's really it. And String Man are the only other real songs. I mean, you've got Frustration, which is frustrating because nobody's singing. And it's the mamas and the papas.
You can tell there's something wrong going on with this group. I mean, there is a lot going on, but nothing is making any sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Also, and it's moving so fast, there's no time to make sense of it. Is String Man written from the point of view of Susie Adams? Because it sounds to me, I saw a pretty girl out in the crowd. She waved at him and caught his eye. The way he looked at her, it made me cry. Who's me? Is that Susie?
I have no idea.
Gotta be Susie.
Yeah.
Gotta be Susie.
Super interesting from a lyrical perspective. That's my favorite element to the song.
For writing a song about your ex-wife's reaction to seeing you with another woman, that's, you know, John did have some very good ideas.
That is incredible. That's
unusual, yeah.
But also, you know, it's one of the reasons why I tried to never date an actress, because an actress will stockpile life experience to use as emotional content for future scenes. So they'll create drama to be able to draw from it. So same with John, is like, I'm going to, you know, fly the plane into the mountain in my life, so I have awesome lyrical content to choose from.
Right?
Is there a little bit of that going on here, you think?
I think so, yeah. I have to admit that I kind of lost interest in a lot of our music because I felt that it was contrived.
At what point did that begin?
Probably after the second album.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the truth. I loved our covers, and I thought that we were utilizing the talent that we had singing and arranging for songs that were already written.
But Papas and Mamas is a lot of things, but it's not contrived.
Okay, what's on Papas and Mamas?
We'll get there.
So talking about String Man Day, we talked about the material. But I love Michelle's vocal on this. I mean, she's strong. So it's very different than Dedicated, because you're wailing. I mean, you're really giving it. And I love it. I mean, Cass is there too, but you really hear the strength of Michelle's voice in String Man. And I love that. And it's just like so much of John's material. I guess you can conceive of it as from Susie's perspective, from what you've pointed out. But Michelle also fell in love with the String Man. So there's a little bit of her singing it too, you know, as her own experience.
This feels like I saw her again last night.
Yeah.
In other words, like, you took me away from my wife. Now you sing a song about stealing me away. Oh my God.
You guys are so funny. You're taking me to a place where I feel like I'm in unfamiliar territory.
What do you mean? Are we looking into it so hard that everything's falling apart?
Yeah, because...
Are we reading into it too much, or is this, or are we hitting it on the head?
Well, I never thought about it. I'm not as cerebral as you are. I never really gave it that much thought.
You're very welcome to do as much research on my life as you'd like as well.
And I'm going to.
Please do. Like I said, Jews make the bad. Never mind. So when you become a major, you'll be getting access to the ultimate director's cuts of all our sprawling super deep dive episodes. As far as I'm concerned, these super cuts have absolutely everything that was meant to be heard. Plus, you get yours before the lieutenants get theirs. But that ain't it. You also get all our other series, like Discography's Top 10, our buried treasure show, Rock Cousteau, our slag-off show, Queasy Listening, and exclusive limited series like The Private Press with Paul Major. And if you've got no financial worries to speak of, keep in mind that some of the higher Patreon tiers allow you to actually advertise on the show, choose the bands we cover, or even some of the guests we get. For the price of a cup of coffee a week, you can ensure my family's fed, build a music library that'll be the envy of your block, and connect to a thriving community of music maniacs all at the same time. Don't risk feeling badly about yourself by not giving. Patreon.com/discograffiti. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti.
So do you have any memories of frustration, which is all instrumental, Michelle? Was it just like, okay, here's a song, I can't think of any words, so let's just throw it on the record?
That's about what it was. It's not pretty. It's not well arranged. There's nothing to that song except an empty vessel of music, but no lyrics.
Right.
So you don't know what the song's about. And I think the most honest thing about that whole song is its title.
Yes, sure. Let me read you my notes on that song. Frustration is a masterpiece, a genius instrumental that has always felt so powerful to me, like it really and truly came from John's heart. Harpsichord led and featuring sections of undeniable intensity, this driving yet reflective tune is absolutely one of your best, even though there's zero vocals. It's always been very powerful to me. And I think that his inability to communicate the frustration, maybe I'm too cerebral, but that concept has always carried the song for me, and I feel it. I do feel that one. And then what's cool after that is that Did You Ever Want to Cry is the vocal companion piece to Frustration.
Mm-hmm.
Am I too cerebral, or are you anytime you think, you know what, you're reading into things and that brain's getting you in trouble, I want you to reach out and glove slap me across the face.
Okay.
Metaphorically. All right. So Did You Ever Want to Cry? What are your feelings on this, Richard? Do you have a similar outlook?
Well, I like it. Here we are at the end of the third album, and John's saying, did you ever want to cry? They all probably want to cry at this point because we're sort of running out of steam. And I find John's music box incredibly unsatisfying. I think you think it's a nice punctuation mark, Dave, but I'm like, what is this? Was it a music box he had, you had? What was it?
I'll tell you. It was a music box that I gave him for Christmas. And the next thing I know, it's going on the album. And he's taking writer's credit for it. Now, that is typically John. And at the very end, I am looking for my dog at the studio. I'm looking all over the studio for my dog. And I open a door and I say, P.O., P.O. And then you hear the door slam, and it slams on the last note of the music box. It's really weird.
I like it.
I like the music box thing.
Here's my very short wrap-up on Deliver. Already by album three, we're feeling the trouble in paradise. We're not punched in the throat by it like we are with your next record, but there are strong intimations on Deliver of either exhaustion or disregard, I think, but also some intense treasures and some of the absolute best work of your career. Too many cover songs on side one and an overall feeling of disjointedness don't take away from the fact that, to me, it's still an absolutely essential record and a classic. I just don't like it quite as much as the first two. So I'll give it 4 3/4 stars. That's still pretty darn good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Do I have to tell you what I think of this album?
Yeah.
Okay, I give it a 3.
Okay, that's fair.
I give it a 4.5, lean on material.
Yeah, I'm just being mean, I guess.
No, you're being honest. Here we go. The initial idea from Monterey and the peak of your fame and power, if I had to stake it all in one time period. It seems like, from everything I can gather, that spring heading into the summer of 67 was a really good time. You were getting along with John, or at least relative to how things were. Yeah, you won the Grammy. This thing fell in your lap that you and John turned into a very different thing because it was a business venture at first. Talk to me about the initial idea for the festival that was brought to you and John.
As well as I remember it, Alan Parisier came to our house. He was our pot dealer, and he came to our house.
Did he have good weed?
The best.
Really?
Really great.
Are we talking about sticks and stems?
It's called Ice Pack because he sold it, you know, in these ice bags, and that's all he used. He just used these ice bags. But anyhow, we're getting off the...
No. It's a good topic. So when I was in high school, all the weed I saw was riddled with sticks and stems. And so I didn't see, you know, the weed that they have now. You touch it, you can't even get it off your finger. There's crystals all over it. Is that what you were smoking back then or no?
No, we were smoking the weeds and the stems and the seeds. But we had Denny Doherty, who loved to just sit and clean pot. He would do that for hours and then he would roll. And so we would have a mound of rolled joints. And we never had to worry about it because he enjoyed doing it.
Let's talk about how the idea was initially presented to you versus how you and John and Lou decided to proceed with it.
Well, he came to the house and said, you know, Benny Shapiro and I have booked two nights at the Monterey Fairgrounds. And we've got this idea of getting a bunch of rock and roll groups to come up and perform for two nights.
And that was June 16, 17, and 18, 1967.
16 and 17 that they had booked. And he said, we want to know if the Mamas and the Papas will close the second night. And then he left and Lou and John started talking about that. They said, obviously, we're not going to go up there and play this date where there would only be like 5,000 people in the audience. And it just wasn't very well thought out. There was no way to get the money. How are they going to get the money? And so I don't know if it was John or Lou, but somebody came up with the brilliant idea of getting artists to do it for free.
Except for fucking Ravi Shankar. What's up with him? 3,500.
Well, Ravi Shankar was booked. And in fact, at the end, he was the only one who actually got paid because he had already been booked. So they had to honor his contract.
You guys had offices set up on Sunset Boulevard, and there's that super cool clip. I've only seen one clip. Richard, I'm sure you've seen a hell of a lot more than me. But, you know, John in his trademark hat, he and Lou really going for the doppelganger thing around that time.
Yeah.
First of all, who was the single white female in the group? Was it Lou or John? Who was the creepy one trying to look like the other guy?
You know, they were like Siamese twins. They had such a great friendship going that they could practically read each other's minds. And someone would come up with an idea, then the other one would build on that. And they got this great idea that they would get a board of governors to back, just with their names, the Monterey Pop Festival. They had Paul McCartney, they had Smokey Robinson, they had Paul Simon, they had Andrew Lou Oldman, they had, I think Mick was also on it, and
the ubiquitous Terry Melcher.
Terry Melcher and Alan Parisier got on there too because he brought the project. They got one more night, so they booked three nights instead of just the two nights. They added a night to it. They got it. It just happened so quickly because we only had 3 months to prepare for this entire project.
You know the film clip I'm talking about where Dionne Warwick calls and John gives you the phone and says,
John, it's Dionne Warwick.
So you guys, just from that tiny clip, it seems like things are smooth. It's an exciting time. You guys are getting along. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but this is the vibe I'm picking up. And just an exciting and capable time. So when I think about what happened with John later, it's almost irreconcilable thinking about a guy who would go down to Monterey around a dozen times, apparently, to meet with civic, political, zoning, housing groups and deliver speeches to them, apparently while tripping on acid, but who the fuck knows?
No, they were not tripping on acid. I don't care what John Phillips says in his book. They were not tripping on acid. As a matter of fact, I've never seen John so businesslike. They were wearing ties and suits to meet with the city councilman, and they were really trying to figure out how they were going to do this. I mean, there were a lot of questions to be asked. How they were
parking. There's no
what about precedent, security?
Right? And for 3 or 4 months, correct me if I'm wrong, this was kind of all the two of you did, right? This was your main focus?
Yeah, there was nothing set up. So once they decide to tell people that this is something that they want them to do for charity, you can see jaws dropping. What do you mean? You're not going to pay us?
Right.
This is just unheard of in rock and roll.
It's a ripple that changed everything. But yeah. What I'm most interested in, actually, is the effect, in a very personal way, that the effect Monterey Pop had on your marriage.
Well, I got a glimpse of John that I had seen when I first met him. He was a real go-getter, and he could charm the birds off the tree, and he could talk to city council members, and he made sure that they all knew that he had gone to Annapolis, and he just wanted them to know that he wanted to make this a safe, fun, controlled environment. Lou Adler called someone in Hawaii and arranged to have 50,000 little white orchids sent to Monterey. They were everywhere.
I think you did that at the ball, too.
Probably did, yeah.
John Landis is a friend of mine, and he was on the show, and he was at that show at the ball, and he remembers the flower on his seat and talked about it during his episode.
It was a very beautiful gesture. It was Lou's idea, and they had friends in Hawaii, you know, DJs and producers, and we had also just played Hawaii. So they wanted to create a magical situation. And it was so wonderful when we could get groups like the Jefferson Airplane to come. And
I love the airplane. I got to say.
I do too. I love the Jefferson Airplane. And she was fabulous. And they were all fabulous.
You know what I love also about them? And I'm not even saying this tongue in cheek. They were the most ideals forward 60s band, like Revolution, fucking in the streets, you know, real out front with that stuff.
Yeah.
And they were the worst violators of their own beliefs in the 70s when they fucking sold themselves down the river a million times over, especially going into the 80s. And to me, that's fascinating. That makes for a fascinating career.
Well, you know, they had a lot of the same problems that we had in our group.
Not so free love, right?
Not so free. No such thing as free love.
Chris and Bruce and sister Sandy Dedrick and younger sister Ellen joined in 1968. Never seemed as simple as they were because of the music. Music was as soft and breezy as and antithetical to the times as it implies. Vocal parts swoop in and out and double back on one another. Dances over and around acoustic guitars in the mix. There's a harpsichord, bongo, tambourine, light bossa nova flavorings, folk, and even touches that told you these kids knew something about jazz.
Jazz. Jazz.
We got jazz, eh? Jazz.
John was very intuitive, and when they said, well, are there going to be drugs? Are we going to have a drug problem? John would say, there's not going to be any drugs. No, this isn't the druggy group, but, you know, we'll have a drug tent just in case someone has a joint or something like that. They thought of everything. They thought of everything that the council was worried about. Yeah. And they were there to address any problem that, you know, could possibly happen.
That question that I asked you about the effect that it had on your marriage, what I'm really wondering is that capable side. That effective mover and shaker, you know.
I love that about him.
Is that why you guys were getting along so well? Because in effect, you were falling in love with him all over again because he was reconnecting with that?
Well, also, there was something for us to do. We were actually getting up in the morning and going to the office.
Right, right.
And I loved watching John and Lou put this together. And they'd say, you know, everyone on the board of directors and me, who was not on the board of directors, but I was there. Everyone got an opportunity to make a suggestion. Who would you like to see at the festival? And I remember when they finally turned to me and they said, who would you like to see at the festival? And without pausing, I just said, Otis Redding. And they said, what a great idea, because we didn't have that soul. Nobody from Motown would come.
Do you have a favorite performer from there that you saw?
Otis.
But was it Otis?
Yeah. I had just seen him at the Apollo.
So Hendrix, I believe, had literally just set his guitar on fire, a totally iconic moment. And then it was your turn. I'm not going to talk about my actual feelings about the set. I'm going to read John's feelings. Here's how he described your set. We ran out on stage and did our songs completely out of tune from start to finish. In parts, we weren't even close. We hadn't sung in months. We hadn't rehearsed at Monterey because Denny wasn't around. Cass had been partying all weekend. I was fried on speed. I had been up for most of the past week. Do you have a similar recollection, or do you remember it as, you know, an amazing, incredible gig?
It's pretty credible.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. It was just a miracle that we even got on stage at all, because the whole stage was destroyed by The Who. And Jimi Hendrix, although he lit his guitar on fire and he smashed it up against his amp, he was smashing his own instruments, which was shocking to me. I had never seen anything like it. I was outraged that you could take your axe and set it on fire. And I did not understand anything about rock and roll theater at that point.
Can I tell you what's so amazing to me about that is not the thing itself. The more I think about this, the more I think this is just like another bulb blowing in the chandelier kind of a thing. John and yourself, but John was, you know, wrote a bulk of the material. John wound up with Monterey opening the door for the next wave, the hard wave, right? The Who, Hendrix. And then these acts basically came in and killed your own band and made you guys... I'm just talking about the very quickly moving cultural shifts of wind at that time. Mm-hmm. Everything's about Sgt. Pepper. No, everything's about getting it together in the country. No, everything's about Marshall amps and stacks. It changed so quickly, and John hastened the band's demise. It's almost like, let's get this over with. There's new kids in the wings who are going to take over for us. Was there any vibe of that? Like, do we want to be showing people what the next step is? Because we'll be killing ourselves if we do that.
Well, from the minute we got off stage, I had so many other things to celebrate and be happy about.
Sure.
And I felt even maybe our marriage might last.
Is that the most hopeful you were for your marriage at that point?
I was conflicted. But preparing for Monterey Pop was one of the best times that I ever had with John. I had a place in the endeavor. I was given a job, which I was good at, getting businesses to buy a page in the Monterey Pop Festival book. And John, I just think it was so brave of John and Lou to take on this festival with so little time, and they used their power and they got people to, you know, sign on to the Board of Governors. If you saw this on the letterhead, you'd say, yeah, I want to be on the Board of Governors.
Yeah.
And then someone would say, well, what do I have to do? And they said, absolutely nothing.
You're talking about John and Lou, though, but weren't you just as much at the head of the whole class as they were? I mean, you were doing just as much as they were, right?
Well, I was working on the festival and I loved doing that. That's all I can remember doing the whole time we were in Monterey, while John and Lou were meeting with the city council and the mayor, and we were meeting with the head of the police department. It seemed like there was something that we were creating that was great. It was going to take a lot of work, and we had to move fast, and we had to get the people to be there, and we had to get them to come in.
You know what? Before we actually sweep past this, we didn't talk about the thing that made all those Learjet trips down to Monterey to talk to the locals. The thing that made the genius move, that I believe was all John, to really put it over the top and create a swish kind of a situation, is San Francisco, be sure to wear flowers in your hair. He basically created a jingle. It's basically a jingle.
Yeah.
It's like the I'm Loving It of 1966.
It becomes a worldwide number one hit.
The actual song that John wrote for the occasion, you did not play a part in that, right? Or were you involved?
I played a little child's instrument at the very beginning. It tinkle, 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 tinkle. And that's what I did. But John and Lou and Scott, John wrote that in one afternoon.
He says 30 minutes, but I'm sure afternoon is more like it. And it was recorded in one night.
In one night in our studio at the house.
On a crap load of speed, apparently.
And it was released 2 days later. It was written, recorded, vocals, everything, and they got it released within 2 days after that.
And the amazing thing about that is that something like that can be done so swiftly. And back in 1993, when I moved to the West Coast, I moved straight to Haight Street because I had heard of it. And I liked the music that came out of that time. But when I got there, it was still feeling the results of that song. Basically, that song changed everything. It changed tons of people's lives. It was written in, let's say, an afternoon. How many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives were immediately changed because they heard that song and they felt like their destiny was out west. And so they left everything they knew and came out there and overran this section of town that was not expecting it. I mean, I lived there for not a long time, but enough to know that this was an area with promise that was hit so hard and swiftly by an incoming cavalcade that decades later, it's still reeling.
Well, it was also the underneath part of it was that it was also like an anti-war song. It was an anthem for young people who wanted peace, love, and flowers. That was the title of it. It said Monterey Pop, Peace, Love, and Flowers. And in the footage, you can see the policemen putting the orchids on their antennas of their motorcycles. You can see them wearing orchids in their hair. These are cops, you know, and there were no bad drug incidents that I have any knowledge of. There was a drug tent, but I don't think it was ever used. People were very happy to have a chair to sit in. It wasn't like Woodstock where people were rolling around in mud and there was rain and people were afraid they were going to get electrocuted on the stage. This was just three gorgeous days in Monterey with flowers, and you could hear people, you know, tuning their guitars, and you see little children running around with their little faces painted and people just lying on their blankets and, you know, eating fruit. And, you know, it was just the perfect visual for 1967. It was just the perfect visual. And then you had this song playing in the background with Scott McKenzie's absolutely incredibly beautiful tenor voice. That was it.
It's the most wonderful song, but the biggest tragedy is that the mamas and the papas didn't either also sing it or sing it as well. I mean, imagine you all doing it. It's just, you know.
ABC Dunhill was so furious with us. But, you know, John wanted to give Scott a part of the success that they had been trying to get together. And that John did not include Scott in the Mamas and the Papas. I don't think that Scott would have done it anyway, even if it had been offered to him. But this was a way to appease him. But who knew?
Yeah, it's a great song. So that's a hard 5 stars for me. I've always loved the song so much. It is so pithy, and it really just did everything and then some that it set out to do. It's an amazing accomplishment.
Yeah, yeah. And also having Ravi Shankar at the festival, although that was already ordained and, you know, that was already, you know, part of the festival when they bought into it, it was the perfect 1967 little taste of what was happening, what was really happening. I can tell you that I could see from my perch at Monterey, I could see that there was something going on here. I don't know what it is.
But you got to love, though. I mean, I love, it was one of my favorite moments in the film when the hippies are clapping for him, but he's just tuning his sitar because they don't really know what's playing and what's tuning on that thing. It's such a hippie disconnect kind of thing. Okay, so San Francisco, 5 stars. I would give your set at Monterey, just your set, because it was released as a record, 4 stars. What does everyone give those two things?
Well, first of all, I would call that recording the Mama and the Papas, because you don't even hear me. I'm not really on the album. I am a little bit. You can hear me in whatever Cass's mic picked up of me. Otherwise, The Who just destroyed my mic. Ooh. It was just not working at all. And it destroyed a lot of the amps.
When you hear the music, you like what you hear? I mean, what would you rate
that? I don't even listen to that album. I think it's so terrible. And because we hadn't rehearsed together, we hadn't sung together in 3 months, that makes a big, big difference in a performance, you know?
That summer is a whole catalog of what seems like a really good time in life. Obviously, you know, we talked about you finding out China was on the way, like immediately. And then a couple of weeks later, by the end of July, Susie, Jeff, and Mackenzie had moved out west. I don't know if that wound up being a good thing, you know, long term, but whatever it was, everyone was all together. So that had to have been, at that time, you know, kind of a warm feeling. It's post Monterey. Everything is with a golden hue on it. So you got China on her way. You're finding the house. John, although, you know, his intentions for building a $100,000 home studio might have seemed cozy and homey at the time. Maybe later on that turned out to not really be the case. So you had him around more often, weekends in Big Bear and Lake Arrowhead, rented airplanes, shuttling you off to Vegas at a moment's notice with Lou, Scott, Keith Richards, Anita Pallenberg, winning $20,000 from a slot machine in the Bahamas, and all this stuff. I'm curious, this time of your life, looking back from the vantage point of Michelle 2023, what is the feeling you get thinking of that time?
All I can remember is I don't even remember going to Canada. I remember going up to Vegas in the 2 Learjets. God. But I was just so preoccupied with my pregnancy and, you know, getting the house pulled together. And at this point, the money was really pouring in. I could buy anything I wanted for the house. John and I used to go to auctions and buy these 200-year-old cuckoo clocks, you know, big, tall cuckoo clocks, and to really furnish a house, a 1932 English Tudor house, and have all the money you wanted to put into it. John and I were having a very good time in our marriage at that point, but I didn't want to record, and I didn't think that we had anything left to record.
Oh, so for you, it was done, even previous. Wow. Well, that certainly is a beautiful transition into phase two. The Chandelier Blows Its Final Bulbs, 1967 to 1968.
All right, that about does it. Stay tuned, because next week we've got part 4 of Michelle Phillips' The Interview of a Lifetime, in which things begin to really go off the rails for the Mamas and the Papas in a big, big way. A heartfelt discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Michelle Phillips, Richard Campbell, Fernando Perdomo, Rudy Fishman, Becky Boyd, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, and access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator. so make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, no sweat. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the greatest music ever made from the 1960s is to leap headfirst into my 12-hour interview with Jules Alexander and Terry Kirkman, the two founding members of Monterey Pop opening act The Association. That's episodes 110 to 113. Vashti Bunyan rating her entire catalog. That's 103 and 104. Os Mutantes Sergio Diaz on the early days of the band, that's 86 and 87. Burt Summer, 83 and 84. A tribute to David Crosby, that's 77 and 78. Lou Barlow rates the Zombies, that's 59 and 60. Bob Forrest on the band, that's 25 and 27. Monkees manager Andrew Sandoval rating the Monkees, that's 22 and 23. The Bee Gees Psychedelic Beginnings, that's episode 10. And Sly and the Family Stone, episodes 5, 6, and 7. Join us during the upcoming week. This Sunday, you can expect another deliriously sociopathic entry of Rudy Fishman's Discography Soldiers of Sound podcast. These are real people with talent and a burning fire deep inside, just like you and I. Get to know your new music-obsessed friends. Then on Monday, our Patreon major tier gets their super extended Ultimate Director's Cut. And then on Wednesday, the Lieutenant tier gets their extended cut. And then the rest of the hoi polloi get theirs. So, of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, April 12th, we're coming at you with Michelle Phillips, The Interview of a Lifetime, Part 4. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discography!
Osiris.